Good morning, diners and travelers of the world. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and you're going to say something. I know that, Peter. Hello.
Am I going to say something? I'm going to say, diners of the world, unite.
Right.
You have nothing to lose as long as you tune in to On the Menu.
Right. Now, especially today, I think I said, because we have some really special guests, starting out with one of the most talented chefs going, Michel Nichon. And I've followed his work for such a long time, and he does so much good. But let's listen to what he's been involved with lately. I'm very happy to be talking to one of my most favorite people and favorite chefs in the whole entire world, Michel Nichon. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. How are you? Wow.
I know.
The whole entire world. That's a big place.
Absolutely.
I have to keep these people apart.
Indeed, you have a vested interest.
I try. Michel's he's such a wonderful man. And you remember we first met you when you were cooking at a place called Heartbeat, and that must seem like almost a lifetime away.
That was back in 97, I think. You know, it's interesting because, what I've been thrilled about is just the way that the things that we've been working on have developed since then. It's really, really astonishing to just see tremendous, success in the slow food movement, the whole foods movement, the whole idea that the public at large is really becoming aware of buying local and what that means to local economies and supporting farmers and all that good stuff. It's really exciting time.
Yeah, I mean, you were doing something fairly radical when you were at Heartbeat. You were using none of these nasty things and preparing absolutely delicious food. Could we just step back a minute and explain to our listeners how you got involved with healthful foods?
Well, it's interesting, Ann and Peter, because I really started always, for the last 30 years, the premise of a lot of my purchasing was based on buying directly from farmers because both my parents came from farm families, one in Kentucky, one in Missouri. And I just always liked farmers. And I knew from common sense that if you ate locally and if you ate in season, that it was just better for you. But the whole notion of really cooking for well-being and being able to identify what the real culprits are in our food system didn't come to me until my son Chris was diagnosed with diabetes at age 5. And that was about 13 years ago.
And how's he doing?
He's doing well, other than the fact that he's adolescent and rebelling a little bit right now. he's 18 years old, all of my payback karma from giving my parents a hard time is all coming back to me, as it should, I suppose. But he's doing well. But, when Chris was diagnosed, that's what led to the creation of Heartbeat, the notion that it's not just about eating good food and eating locally and eating in season to get maximum nutrients, but also really great flavor, which is something that's a notion that's existed for millennia. But the whole notion of the things that you really should try to avoid, the highly processed wheat products, highly processed corn products, highly processed soy products, as good as soy is supposed to be for us, the way that these products are often processed, the consumption of them, especially in the quantities that many Americans eat them, really isn't in the best interest of human health, the sweeteners, all of that stuff. So, I really started to learn about that once Chris was diagnosed, that the things that really could cause the most harm to human health, were pretty easy to avoid if you had a really great local food system that you were following, and I think we all know the flavor of one of those dreaded February tomatoes from the grocery store that was, picked in Holland 5 weeks before it turns ripe, gas with nitrogen, sent over on a container, gas with ethylene, turns red, puts it, and the difference between that and a vine-ripe tomato that you can get from the farmer's market. And from what I understand from earlier conversations with you both, Pittsburgh is like number 3 in the country for farmer's market per capita or something. So I think your listeners all know what a ripe, really good ripe tomato is. And when you can serve people that quality of food, you really don't need to thicken sauces with roux. You really don't need to have white bread. You don't need to use processed sugar. When you have a perfectly ripe peach to make a dessert with, it's not something you need to add high fructose corn syrup to make it good, So that was the premise of Heartbeat, and it remains the premise of a lot of my cooking today,
But you're so technically accomplished. I mean, you can really pull flavors out of anything, I think.
Well, I tried it with a shoe once, and it didn't work.
Didn't work.
now, Michelle, there are some specific things that you've been doing recently that brought you to our attention. Not that we wouldn't love you to have you as a guest on the program every week, but there are a couple of cool things going on with something to do with Victory Gardens.
Oh yeah, last year we shot 10 segments of Victory Garden. Victory Garden kind of made a change in format and invited me to host a segment, a regular segment that was a cooking segment called Homegrown. And the segments were shot in Lori, my wife Lori, and I have a quarter acre organic garden in our backyard. We shot there with Kip Anderson, the renowned master gardener for Victory Garden. And, you know, we would do an agricultural piece on the garden, and then it would always end in a cooking segment showing people very simple ways of how to cook the food. And one of the segments, we actually visited a farm that was doing native Three Sisters agriculture, which is where you plant corn, beans, and hard squash pumpkins in the same mound. And it's a sustainable method of agriculture. Corn takes nitrogen out, beans put nitrogen
right
back in, the pumpkins provide, you know, shade and weed control, et cetera. And that segment won a James Beard Award, Media Award, so we're very proud of that.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, well, I'm pleased about that, and we feel like it's an accomplishment, but we're all very excited that what it shows is that I think the public at large is beginning to really respond well to understanding the importance of really great local sustainable agriculture.
Yeah, we were just
talking. Historically successful ways of doing it.
The better mention that we're talking about Victory Garden, we're talking about PBS TV.
Right, that's PBS. It's a television program and it's been running for about 32 years, the Victory Garden. It's one of their most successful programs. It's really special.
And you were also involved with giving healthy alternatives for cooking on the grill.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, many of our segments did that last year. You know, it's interesting because the summer is a time of year where no matter where you are in the country, there's abundance of agricultural product, really great local product. And people love to grill. You know, you want to cook outside. You don't want to cook in a hot kitchen, you know, especially with electricity bills now. A lot more people are turning the air conditioner off, you know, and turning to the grill outside. And, you know, the interesting notion is that, you know, the grill can be an amazing place to really express the bounty of summer in a way that's really good for your health. It's also a great way to destroy the bounty of summer and also negatively impact your health. You know, there are healthy ways of grilling and there are unhealthy ways of grilling. And I'd love to point out just some of the simple tips.
Yeah, why don't you do that for us?
Well, you know, let's take eggplant for instance.
Oh, that's
a lot of
right
folks
on,
like.
Yep.
Do you like eggplant?
Yeah, but that's right at the top of my list. They load it down with oil and put it on the grill to the point where it absorbs the oil and is greasy.
Yeah, well, it's greasy, but also another problem, Anne, is that the oil weeps out. And when the oil weeps out and hits the coals or the gas grates that act like coals in a gas grill,
right,
it immediately scorches and smokes and creates carcinogens.
Oh, no.
Now, a lot of folks have said, and a lot of, you know, a lot of health, you know, people that are authorities on health in cooking have said that all grilling is carcinogenic, and that's not completely true. When you look at properly managed and maintained coals or a really hot grill, that activity and that heat is not carcinogenic. It's the smoke that it creates. So when you put something on the grill and it starts dripping a lot of fat and it smokes a lot, you see that thin gray film kind of like coating everything on the outside, that's the carcinogenic stuff. So the way that you avoid that, and this is the most amazing thing in the world because it saves you money also. You don't oil everything before you put it on the grill. With eggplant, you don't have to oil the eggplant before you put it on the grill. You slice the eggplant, and you can slice it into thick slices, and you oil the grill grates. You take a rag, and you rub the grill grates with an oil that has a high flash point, like grapeseed oil, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And then you put the eggplant on the grill, and it'll grill without sticking, and it will not smoke at all. You've got that nice hot heat coming up from the coals or from the gas coils, and you're not creating any smoke whatsoever. When you grill it and it's grilled to kind of this perfect doneness, you take it off the grill and then you brush it with some really high quality extra virgin olive oil. You're using 90% less oil, and the oil is still floral and beautiful because you take this beautiful, fruity, extra virgin olive oil and brush it on a piece of warm food, it's going to taste beautiful. You soak the food in the extra virgin olive oil, and then you burn the extra virgin olive oil, you get no flavor benefit. All you get are carcinogens.
Now, hold on a second, Michelle. Let me talk about my system for a second, because otherwise, if you're right, I'm going to have to change the way I do
things.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
But what I do is I will if I like, I'll get the scorch that I want on the eggplant or the zucchini, which is what I cooked last night, on the hot side of the grill. And then I move the vegetable to the cold side of the grill that doesn't have any coals underneath it. Mm-hmm. And that's when I apply the oil and whatever rub I might want to put on it.
That's very helpful as well.
So that's okay?
Yeah, that is okay, because basically what you're doing is you're using the grill now to bake or roast the item. You're marking it. As long as when you're marking it, there's no oil on the item, great shape.
None at all. I'm glad I went over there with it, because that's exactly how I've been teaching my son how to grill since at age 31. He's now finally decided that it's something he ought to know about. and I would hate to have told him the wrong thing.
You're doing well. The difficulty is that most people marinate things for a long time before they put them on the grill. They don't wipe them off.
Okay.
They don't dry them. They soak eggplant in oil for long periods
of
time.
That's what I hate, yeah.
And it really is. There's only one method of soaking with eggplant that works, and it's worth mentioning because it's kind of unorthodox. It's in one of my cookbooks. I forget which one. I think it's in Homegrown. But what you do is you cut an eggplant in half. You don't cut it into slice, and you put the cut side down in a dish that has some extra virgin olive oil and some good sea salt in it, and you allow the eggplant to suck up some of that beautiful extra virgin olive oil, and what you do is you put it on the grill to the side of the coals so it's not dripping on coals, and you close the lid, and what happens is the eggplant cooks and basically simmers itself in its own juices and oil, and it makes this beautiful emulsion and this beautiful, silky, soft eggplant flesh. And right at the end, you can spoon just some freshly chopped heirloom tomatoes, grate some fresh pecorino romano on top, close the lid until the cheese barely melts, and you have kind of like a grill top eggplant parmesan. But again, the cut side is never down, so you're not marking the cut side.
You do know what you're doing. I must say, I'm always impressed with how
why wouldn't he know?
I know, but he really is brilliant.
Good thing I know something.
You ought to have picked up something by now. Now,
yeah, I would hope so.
Now, we absolutely can't conclude our discussion here without talking about your current restaurant adventure,
dressing room,
and your good buddy, Mr. Joanne Woodward.
Yes, Mr. Joanne Woodward. I like that. That's very, very good. He would agree that would be his name.
I'm sure he would.
So now, is that similar? The menu is similar to the Heartbeat. I mean, you're doing
no, that. Actually, Ed, it's quite a bit different. Heartbeat was a little more technical. We did things like, you know, cutting the raw kernels off of an ear of sweet corn, juicing it raw and heating the raw juice until it thickened itself.
That's
to get
true.
A sauce.
Right.
What we're doing with Dressing Room is really trying to restore some of the heritage recipes that once defined us very positively to the rest of the world before we became the land of golden arches and striped bucket.
American, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Things
and you're
like
in
chicken
Connecticut.
And dumplings, like meatloaf, like Yankee pot roast, you know, really wonderful, wonderful dishes that once were cooked extremely well were very healthfully prepared because people were grinding their own flour and using all of it when they made dumplings. We grind all of our own flour.
Gee,
so it's
really?
Kind of a marriage between real kind of, you know, that you know, real American heritage food that once defined us and some of the principles that we used at Heartbeat. All of it is based on buying our product from local suppliers, local fruit and vegetable farmers. We buy our pig whole, split in half, so that we can buy from small local hog producers who use Animal Welfare Institute protocols that feed their animals, you know, organically and allow them to exhibit their natural behavior, range-fed, basically. It's just a really great American restaurant. We fund and manage two active farmers markets, one in our parking lot on Thursday, so it's kind of like getting our produce delivery for the weekend.
Oh, wow.
When the farmers market shows up on Thursday, and then we use those markets to leverage local foods deep into underserved and historically excluded communities.
Yes, and is this moving us into Wholesome Way a bit?
Yeah, that's Wholesome Wave. That's our nonprofit foundation.
Oh, it's Wave, W-A-V-E?
Yes, Wholesome Wave Foundation. And interestingly, what we do is we have some interesting innovations. What we do, for instance, with our program is we get wholesale opportunities from our farmers because the markets are so successful. We pack CSA-style boxes full of fruits and vegetables, and then we go and open a farm stand at a soup kitchen deep in a historically excluded community, and then we have funding to double the value of food stamps, WIC coupons, and senior food coupons.
Oh, that's brilliant. Really?
Which is, yeah, well, it what it does is it levels the playing field when you look at most people who have food coupons. When they go to a grocery store, they can only shop the center aisles because it's the only food they can afford because those foods are made with highly subsidized ingredients. What we do is we're leveling the playing field by kind of giving people more buying power provided they use their food coupons to buy fresh local fruits and vegetables. So we just in Holyoke, Massachusetts yesterday announced a grant to an organization called Nueces Right, where when people come to the farmer's market and turn in their WIC coupons and their food stamps, they get double value coupons, so they get double the buying power. And it was just really exciting to see, you know, pregnant women with their kids, you know, buying peaches for the first time because they could actually afford it. Really cool stuff. Everybody should get to eat a ripe peach.
Yeah, no, I mean, does this tie into any national programs? Because a woman at the gym was telling me, she's at one of the Silver Sneakers, and she was telling me that she and her husband go to a community center and get a once a month and get a coupon for the farmer's market.
Yeah, well, the national program, our chairman is Gus Schumacher, who's the former Undersecretary of Agriculture under Clinton.
All right, great.
And over the last, 8 years, he worked with USDA to get an exception that allows farmer's markets and farm stands to accept food stamps and WIC coupons. The interesting notion, though, Ann and Peter, is that if someone goes to a farmer's market with a $10 food stamp and then they see a quart of tomatoes for $10, it's not a good experience for them. What we're trying to do is turn that 10 into 20 so that they actually can buy a reasonable amount of food to feed their families. And it's a conditional addition. They have to choose to spend their food stamp on fresh local fruits and vegetables, and if they do that, we double the value.
I think that's fabulous.
And we are going to go into San Diego, and we're talking to folks in Detroit, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi as well, because we believe that it's worth proving that if you give access and sufficient resource, that people from historically excluded communities will absolutely happily make the right food choices for their family.
Well, wow. this is all absolutely wonderful stuff, Michelle. It's really fun. I think we ought to convert this program. We should call it On the Menu with Michelle Nichon.
so we can
have you on every week, because unfortunately we must find time to include some other business in the program. But we keep on threatening to come visit, and I keep on telling Miss Ann to find a date. I say, no, it's not that far.
We need to do it when Michelle's there, because that's the point of going.
And we should go on a Thursday.
Indeed. Thursday. You should see the market and then have dinner Thursday night.
Okay, great.
Okay, well, if you hang on a bit and give me your direct email address, then we'll be able to line that up and get there.
Okay. Michelle, we'll say goodbye to you officially on the program. Thank you so much for joining us. It was always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, Michelle.
My pleasure, too.
Keep moving forward like that.
Keeps me out of trouble, my wife will tell you.
Well, Michelle is always such an inspiration. I really enjoy talking to him and keeping up with what he's doing. And now I think it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please email us at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you.
That, of course, assumes that you have something sensible to say.
Well,
or you have a good question to ask, and I'm sure you do, so we'll certainly look forward to hearing from you. Peter, I just wanted to get a word in there because it was a bit difficult when Anne and Michelle were talking to each other. I just wanted you to know that I'm still here. and what are we doing in the next segment?
We're doing talking about bistro brasserie food.
Of the French style, but curious enough, book written by an Englishman and an American, and it's the American that we're talking to, but he really does a fine job, so I'm sure you'll be very interested.
If anyone's interested in the difference between a bistro and a brasserie, or if anybody is seeking the ultimate of classic French comfort food, there's a new book on the market. And we're here with John Fisher, who is a co-author of this book produced by the CIA, which is called Bistros and Brasseries, Recipes and Reflections on Classic Cafe Cooking. And when I say CIA, I mean the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you had some fun producing this book because you and your co-author bounced all around France finding wonderful places to eat, right?
Well, it wasn't so much bouncing as circumlocuting. It was a very, very directed trip, and we drove over 2,000 kilometers in just 7 days, starting in Reims, up in Champagne, and then going around and eventually ending up back in Paris, only to spend a day and a half in London on the way home to the U.S. We were so driven, literally and figuratively, that we didn't even eat lunch every day. We would have a quick continental breakfast in the morning, really continental breakfast, and then be in the car until we got to our location that night, and essentially just lived on dinners for the entire time.
That's how we travel.
Now, how many your dinners must have consisted of quite a large number of courses.
It depended, of course, on the place. When we went to Bocuse, it was way too many courses.
Yeah.
Paul Bocuse did visit the school, the Culinary Institute, in 1989, and we called it Bocuse-a-rama because the school was so clean that it was visible from space for 2 weeks. But he came and visited and was so impressed by the school that he sent his own son there as a student.
Really?
And, of course, the most famous chef in France sends his son to an American cooking school. It raised some French eyebrows, which we liked. We liked the fact that the French were a little upset with Bocuse for sending his son to the U.S. But Bocuse has maintained a friendship and a relationship with the school ever since. And we went for dinner. And in addition to the normally filling menu anyway, he sent extra courses.
Oh, yeah.
Which just by the end of the night, we were all going home. None of us could sleep well. And we all had heart palpitations for the amount of fat that we had basically mainlined into our bloodstreams that night.
That happened to me at the French Laundry the first time I went, because Thomas knows us. He sent out, did the big tasting menu, but he sent out 12 courses before we even started on that.
It's a very dangerous thing to be friends with a person in the kitchen.
This is true. Now, how did you determine your itinerary? How did you select where you were going to eat? I mean, the choices are so overwhelming.
Well, other than the famous, most famous Bocuse, we actually left ourselves in the very able hands of our cohort at that time, Xavier Leroux, who is... was at that point the evening chef at the Escoffier Room restaurant, the one that I still teach in. And Xavier is from Brittany, and we used his expertise and his knowledge of his home country to lead us to different places from town to town. And in some cases, you know, we got to France at one point, and the restaurant that we had, which was I think it was 2 or 3 stars that we had a reservation at in Paris on our last night in France, chose to cancel our reservation because it had not been confirmed in the proper time frame. So we had to kind of look around and ended up happily at restaurant Hélène de Rose.
Oh, sure.
And she, of course, has the most stars of any woman in Europe.
Yes,
at 2 stars. And
there's another one.
Correction.
There's a 3-star.
Uh-oh.
There's actually a 3-star Michelin chef in France as of this year, and there's one in Spain as of 2005 or 2006.
Well, the trip was 4 years.
Well, then you got it in. You're in good shape. But let's just make sure that there's truth in advertising on the menu.
Yes,
so
I do not want to misspeak.
So that people know there are now 5 women with
3
Michelin stars, only 3 of which are real chefs.
Well, it's about time.
Yeah, yeah, well,
absolutely, it's about time. And I just had to go into the door. So that was why I was missing for a while, but I'm back right now. Now did you already talk about the difference between a brasserie and a bistro?
No, I was just about to do
that. Okay, well, then I'm reading your mind.
Okay, why don't you tell us the difference briefly? I mean, I know there's a lot of history to the bistro. Let's do bistro, B-I-S-T-R-O, bistro, B-I-S-T-R-O-T, and brasserie.
Well, there's a kind of a foggy history to one and a more real history to the latter. And as a sort of a preamble to this, it is, to me, I tend to choose words carefully, and it upsets me when I see Billy Joe's Pizza Bistro as a sign on the side of the road.
Right.
And bistro is not, neither should it be Billy Joe's, nor should it be Pizza Bistro. One of the apocryphal stories is that there's a word in Russian that sounds like bistro. And when there were Russian soldiers in Paris, they would be urging their service staff to move more quickly by saying something that sounded like bistro, bistro. Now, that is probably the most heard story with regard to where the term came from. But as our world is woefully underdocumented, I don't think anybody really knows where the word bistro came from, whether it's misused now or not. I think of a bistro, and most people in our business do, think of it as a casual French restaurant that serves essentially French comfort food. It might be dumbed down haute cuisine or elevated home cooking, but in either case, it's meat and vegetables and starches, and sauces are more often just the reduced braising liquid than an actual prepared sauce from demi-glace or emulsion or whatever. So bistro, in my mind and a lot of other people's minds, is really just a simple French restaurant.
And price has nothing to do with it, huh?
Well,
I'm thinking particularly of Les Amis Louis in Paris, the asparagus once about 10 years ago was $55 for an appetizer.
Yeah,
it's called a bistro.
I grouse a little bit at that, a bistro should be approachable in more ways than just one.
Right.
I think it should be approachable financially as well. And is the kind of restaurant where you would go once a week, perhaps. If you don't have, if you live in Paris and you don't have a big kitchen or a big oven, like living in New York City,
mm-hmm.
you go to a neighborhood restaurant for your roast chicken or your whatever would normally take 3 days to cook at home, but you don't have the time or space. So bistro is not easily defined word-wise, but I think in genre it's pretty easy to define. And with regard to the T at the end, that I, you know, how many ways are there to spell Gravlax?
Yeah, that's true too. I had forgotten about that one.
Okay, Gravlax, so. Gravadlax, Gravio. You know.
So on to brasserie.
So brasserie is actually from a Middle French word that means brewery. So the brasserie essentially is a casual restaurant. It's the French equivalent of a brew pub, and beer is more likely the beverage of choice than wine. And some of the brasseries that are in Paris do come from Alsace, Alsatian origin. So Beaufanger, the most famous brasserie in Paris, Monsieur Beaufanger was an Alsace refugee who came to Paris and actually was the first person to serve draft beer in Paris.
Amazing.
He probably came there in 1871 after the Franco-Prussian War.
I'm not sure of the exact year, but it was during the time of the Franco-Prussian War.
You don't list the places that I couldn't find. I thought you were going to list the places that you ate at these on your tour.
Well,
they in
the tour de gastronomique that we took and the brasserie and bistro dining series that we did were not necessarily planned together.
Okay.
So we went to restaurants in France that would not fit into the category. We did go to Beaufanger, but we also went to Gordon Ramsay in London. So that is not a brasserie or a bistro.
Did you go to Chelsea?
not even close.
Did you go to Chelsea?
And it was the best, believe it or not, our dinner at not to offend Monsieur Bocuse, but our dinner at Gordon Ramsay was the best meal we had on the trip.
That was the one in Chelsea did you go to?
It's the eponymous three-star.
The original one. I can still see and taste the lunch we had there, and it was 5 or 6 years ago.
That's wonderful.
I can also still feel it in my hip pocket nerve as well.
Well, same here. The meal that we had there was, as I tend to be very, not apologetically so, but I tend to be very kind towards restaurants that I attend. In my reviews of them later, or not reviews, because I'm not a reviewer, but when I speak of them. And as positive as I always tend to be, I never use the word perfect. Well, the meal at
Gordon Ramsay
was perfect.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. I couldn't find fault. I'm used to being, you know, I did 14 years stint as a restaurant critic, so I'm critical, and I couldn't find anything to complain about.
And perfect in every way, not just perfect, like a perfectly cut diamond. The service was perfect in its demeanor and warmth, and it just the entire meal was. I could not have asked for.
I even liked the other customers.
Yeah, the customers are nice,
and from what I've heard, they control that too.
And the maitre d', who's French, is French in all the best ways. So we had a wonderful time. But you can also have a wonderful time in bistros now. Our favorite bistro in Paris used to be Benoit, but we understand that Monsieur Ducasse bought it and now has one in Japan, and he has one in New York, which is getting truly panned by the critics.
I had heard of that new one in New York. In fact, he had sent a little bit of a flair for help from Manhattan up to the culinary, and I don't know what exactly is going on down there, but he's going to need to get it corrected pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's what we read. Anyway,
talk about this book. I mean, this
back to the subject. Are we talking about this book or not?
Yes, I just said back to this book.
Okay, good.
You weren't listening, Rabbit.
I was listening.
But I'm saying that if, in fact, you want to make the most classic salade niçoise, you would come to this book, and there it is.
If you want the steak frites with or without the steak, come to this book.
Or celery remoulade. Or
French coleslaw.
Yeah.
That's a nice idea.
Or tartare-style salmon. Or, you know, what else can I say? Sauteed frog's legs with woodland mushrooms. You know, I don't know if there's anything missing in this book of the ultimate classics.
Well,
we
have a roast chicken and the roast capon.
The coq au vin you have.
Coq au vin.
Escargot de bourguignon.
You must have some daubs in there somewhere, no doubt.
Yeah, there's a braised lamb shank recipe. That is one of my favorites.
Oh, we better dig that one out.
Oh,
we love lamb shanks.
Well, that dish in particular it's interesting in that it's from a New York chef named Tom Valenti.
I know Tom. Yeah,
he's the greatest. He's just such a sweetheart and one of the funniest, not just chefs, but one of the funniest people I know. And I worked in Manhattan restaurants for 12 years after I graduated from the culinary and in the front of the house. So I've been a maitre d' and sommelier and wine director and all that. Although I'm a culinary graduate, I went to culinary school to learn how to cook so I could be a better dining room person.
Oh.
And became friends with a number of chefs because chefs are a lot more fun to hang out with than other maitre d's.
I'm sure you're absolutely right.
So I got to know Tom pretty well, and at that point he was in a little restaurant called, and the history of the recipe, I believe, is in the
Tom Valenti's Lamb Shank, page 124.
Tom was in a little tiny restaurant called Allison on Dominic.
Yes.
And he got so well known for this lamb shank recipe that the rumor is, and the urban myth is that he single-handedly raised the wholesale price of lamb shanks in New York City because they became so popular.
Like Paul Prudhomme wiped out redfish.
Exactly. So the recipes aren't necessarily all from your French grandmother. Some are from chefs in New York City. But it all does boil down to comforting and easy to make French food.
Yeah, it's because it's not just a country; it's a style, right?
Yeah, and as Tom got famous for his, even if he didn't coin the term, country French food is how his food was often described years ago. And there's a very famous brasserie in New York City called Blue Ribbon. It's where we used to go after work because they would serve food until 4 a.m.
Yeah,
and I would get out of work at 2 a.m. and be starving because the last time I had eaten was 5 o'clock that evening. And we would go there and have marrow bones with oxtail marmalade and things like that. And one of my favorite dishes there was the dish that's in the book, which is the sauteed calamari. And it's just got all the ingredients you would expect sauteed calamari to have. It's calamari, butter, olive oil, garlic, and parsley. But the way that the dish is put together is essential to it tasting the way it does at the Blue Ribbon Brasserie.
Well, and I think we could go on talking about this, but I think what we need to do is we need to tell our listeners that this book needs to be on the cookbook shelf.
And we're going to put it on our website so people can go directly to onthemenuradio.com and click on it and order it.
And then get it dirty.
Exactly.
And then get it dirty.
Get that book off the shelf.
And splashed all over the pages, right?
Yeah, you've seen, who is it, the washable cookbook. Whose was that?
Charlie Palmer.
Charlie
Palmer's washable.
Yeah.
We have that one. Anyhow.
He's not a culinary graduate.
Well, say hi to my fellow Brit Lou the next time you see him.
I will do that.
I mean, it's really kind of disappointing that we don't have a Brit talking about French food on the program. That one.
I do a pretty good British accent.
You do? Okay. Well,
I worked with Lou for 5 years, so I picked up his accent.
Well, thank you so much for joining
John,
the program.
Yeah, and keep in touch with your next project. And say hello to all our CIA buddies.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Bye, John.
Bye-bye.
And it's time now for another break.
And we hope you'll come back and join us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And as always, we'd love to hear from you.
And we've got some ingredient stuff coming up, right? Some special ingredients to make your cooking even better.
Well, yes, and we're going to jump around a bit. They're going to take you, first of all, to the land of the rising sun, and then, well, I'm going to just leave that hanging as to where we're going to take you for the next
trust me, folks, you'll be happy that you stayed on for the last interview following the one from Sanjay. It's just one of the most unusual ones I think we've ever had on the menu, so you'll want to hear for sure.
We have marketing manager Jennifer Stultz of Sanjay, the company that she's going to explain to us, on the line. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, Jennifer's my daughter-in-law's name. So that's a good name.
Jennifer says she has a small voice, but she's going to be a good girl and speak up for us.
I will try.
Because the guys on the other side of the mic and on the menu tend to have rather loud voices.
Now, you're going to help explain this company. I just had no idea. I thought of it as soy sauce. Had no idea the huge lineup of products made by Sanjay. You tell me that this is an old company. Can you explain how it started, where it started, why it's called Sanjay, and where you are now in the U.S.?
Sure. Sanjay's founder is actually called Sanjurushi Corporation, and it was established in 1804 in Japan, and it was established by the Sato family. And they started the company as a tamari and miso company. And what they did is, in about 1978, they decided to bring tamari to the United States, and they began working as an importer to the natural and industrial food market. And because tamari proved to be so so popular in the U.S., they decided to build a factory here, and they settled on Richmond, Virginia, and established a factory in about 1987. We're still here in Richmond, Virginia. This is where we produce and brew our tamari. And right now, the current president of Sanjay, Takashi Sato, is the 8th generation of the founding family.
Now, that's history. That is history.
For those people who don't know, what is tamari?
That was my next question.
Well, I'm ahead of you, as always.
Yeah.
It's a type of soy sauce.
Okay.
It's naturally brewed, and it's made with more soybeans than regular soy sauce. So it's going to have a richer, smoother, more complex taste than regular soy sauce, which is made with about 50% soybeans, 50% wheat, whereas tamari is almost 100% soybeans. So instead of covering up the flavors of food, it's really going to enhance those natural flavors of whatever you're cooking.
Is it umami?
Yes, that's a part of it. Umami is kind of a difficult concept to explain, especially for Westerners. But
I know. We had somebody who wrote a book about it on, and that was really tough.
Basically, the fifth flavor, in addition to sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. And I think the best way to describe it is it really enhances the other flavors, and it imparts that savory taste to food.
Right. And then you do how many variations on tamari?
We make our regular tamari, and then we have a reduced sodium version of it. And in addition to that, we have an organic wheat-free tamari and wheat-free reduced sodium tamari.
And so those are they're gluten-free, in other words.
Yes, they're certified gluten-free, so they're really ideal for people who are on wheat-restrictive diets.
Right. There must be a lot of them, because there are a lot of products out there aimed for these people.
Yes, a lot of people are concerned with it, either for health reasons or certain diets, and they call us and ask us about the gluten status of our product. And it's really been a big help to have it certified gluten-free, because it gives people a little bit more confidence in using the product.
Right.
Now, would you say that the products that you're making in Richmond are identical to the ones being produced in Japan?
I'd say it's very similar to the tamari being produced in Japan. We actually have several people in our lab who are here from the founding company in Japan,
okay.
And they help us with the brewing process. And we have new people who come here every 8 to 10 years who work here. They help us develop new flavors. They help us with the tamari brewing process. So definitely, we're using those same traditional techniques that were originally used in order to brew tamari.
Now, but the soybeans are produced in the United States.
We get them from a variety of
okay.
locations.
Okay.
I know in the past we were getting them from the Midwestern part of the U.S., and it just varies where we get them from.
Now, what about the miso sauce? Do we have that too? I don't remember.
No, we don't have any miso, but we have all kinds of different flavorings. For example, we used
sesame.
We used tamari sesame. It was some kind of
marinade.
Dip and marinade, and we marinated
scallops.
Large sea scallops in it last evening, and it was just really delicious. And you've got a range of that kind of product as well, correct?
Yes, and we have a line of salad dressings, which the tamari sesame is part of. We also make a full line of Asian cooking sauces, soups, and rice crackers.
Wow.
And trust me, listeners, you can use the Jennifer's
yes.
calling salad dressing can certainly be used as marinades. It does say that on the label as you read the label, and we've used it very successfully that way, and it just imparts an absolutely delicious flavor on the grill.
Now, what direction are you going to be moving in with this? I mean, these are classic sauces. I mean, how many liberties can you take with?
Well, what we're trying to work on right now is, because the gluten issue is becoming so big, we are working on making some of our sauces gluten-free, trying to reformulate them a little bit and make them more acceptable for a wider range of diets.
Hmm. But of course you have the challenge of saying, well, that's fine, but it also has to taste like Sanjay, otherwise it's not worth doing.
Yes, that's true.
Well, and I guess that everybody's clamoring for more and more Asian food, so you're right in the right place at the right time.
Yes, we are, and we're certainly planning on expanding our line and bringing new sauces and new dressings to the line in the near future.
Yes, you do have, I should mention, you have Thai peanuts. I guess that's very popular with everybody.
That's one of our most popular sauces, as well as the hot and spicy Szechuan sauce.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we haven't tried that yet.
That one's, I feel that in my future somewhere. I'm very fond of warm flavors. I don't know what we're going to do about having a dish that combines that with Anne's taste for things that are slightly milder, but I'm sure we'll work something out.
Well, maybe we can combine it with that awful beef tongue that you have.
There we go. Now, for listeners...
That's a thought, Rabbit. You can braise your beef tongue in this hot sauce.
For our listeners around the world, because... Clearly, Sanjay or San, whatever the rest of the J's
it's called, Sanjay
are available undoubtedly all through the Far East. Sanjay products are available throughout the United States, and I'm guessing probably Canada as well. What about the rest of the world?
At this time, they're not widely available in Europe. You'll mostly find them here in the U.S., across the U.S., and in Canada as well.
You know, you have this kind of interesting buyer beware. In your press kit, I thought it was kind of interesting about how to spot chemically created soy sauce versus what yours is naturally brewed.
I don't even want to go there. I don't even want to think about that. Beware of.
So, no, I mean, this is why I was interested in this, because some of that, the commercially produced soy sauces are just so, they just taste metallic practically.
Yes, the chemically produced sauces are made in a matter of just a few days. They use artificial flavoring and coloring, whereas Sanjay Tamari would take 5 to 6 months to produce, and it's made with all natural ingredients, no additives or preservatives, no artificial additives or preservatives, no added MSG.
And the great thing about it as a result of that is not only is it good for you, but it tastes better. What a novel concept.
Jennifer, do you speak Japanese?
I do not, unfortunately.
Oh, because I was going to say arigato, which is all I know besides okay.
Do you ever get to New York?
Yes.
When you go to New York, if you want a wonderful Japanese experience, there's a tea store, worldwide headquarters of a Japanese company called Ito N, and a wonderful restaurant on the second floor called Kai.
Yes, I've been there.
Oh, you've been there. I might have known you'd be ahead of us.
Did you love it?
Yes, it's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Okay, well,
so
listen,
serene and beautiful.
I guess we've had them on the program anyway. So people who were on the menu fans already know about them. But I'm pleased to see that their fame is spreading to other people who are interested in things Japanese.
Yeah, and is there anything you'd like to add to this interview, Jennifer? That you'd like to tell people?
Well, I would just love for everyone to go out and taste tamari and see the difference in what it tastes like compared to regular soy sauce. And most people, once they taste it, they don't go back to using ordinary soy sauce again. Love tamari.
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful product.
Well, thanks to Jennifer, we won't have to go back to doing that for quite a long time. So we'll be checking out the shelf life of your products. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing them with us, and it was a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, boy. And next up, listeners, remember you heard it here first. Here it is. Now, there is a certain irony about this product, kosher bacon salt. It's not bacon at all, and we have Justin Esch on the phone who's going to tell us all about this product. Why don't you start, Justin, by saying how you envisioned this idea.
Okay. Well, first, Anne, Peter, I just want to thank you for having me on the program. Visioning this product was really kind of by absolute happenstance. My brother and I were at a wedding for a childhood friend in New York. It was actually a Jewish wedding. We were eating kosher food. And my brother and I, at the dinner table, were discussing our fondness for a drink, a cocktail, actually, that's served at a bar where we grew up in our hometown, which is a shot of bourbon, of Maker's Mark. with a garnish of bacon, like if you imagined a tequila shot with a wedge of lime.
Wow.
It's called a Mitch Morgan shot, a shot of bourbon with a side of bacon. And we were discussing this, and we were hanging out, and we were laughing and having fun with our friends, and you know, they were talking about being, you know, maintaining a kosher diet and not eating bacon, and my brother and I were talking about how much we loved bacon, and all this kind of came together, and I just proudly proclaimed that I thought the world needed a seasoning salt that tasted and smelled like bacon. And it was really just kind of a funny little side note and a joke for several months until I told my soon-to-be business partner, Mr. Dave Lefko, who I'm sorry he couldn't join this afternoon, about the idea, and he about jumped out of his chair, and he said, "I'm from Chicago, and I think everything should taste like bacon, and we should do it." And that was it. Just casually over dinner, told him the story. And
well, now, how do we get this funding from the world's funniest video?
Well, we set out. We had no idea what we were doing. We had less than no idea what we were doing. We had no money either. And while we were discussing bacon salt, we were at Dave's house just having a little barbecue and drinking a couple beers. And in the backyard, Dave's son hit a T-ball bat, and the ball hit Dave in the face and caught it on video. His wife suggested he turn it into America's Funniest Home Videos. And 1 week later, we won $5,000, which was the money that we used to fund the business with.
Now, are you yourself? You keep kosher. You're of the Jewish faith, so you can't eat bacon.
Well, I'm not. However, Dave is Jewish.
Okay.
However, neither of us maintain a kosher diet. I try to. I like a lot of kosher foods. Dave is definitely a bad Jew who loves good bacon. But it definitely was just something that we set out to do when we found out we could do it.
And you have four different flavors.
Yeah, that's right. Bacon salt comes in original, hickory, peppered, and as well we manufactured a natural version, which is based on the Whole Foods approved ingredient.
And how is it actually, I mean, without giving away any trade secrets, I mean, what is it actually made of?
We stole the souls of pig.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, right.
I'm sure you've practiced that one a long time.
Okay, so the product, the first thing is, it is bacon salt. So the primary ingredient of the product is sea salt. We used a high-quality sea salt to use the product in, but what we were able to do is actually make it low sodium. So it contains less than 75% of the sodium of iodized table salt by using the sea salts. And then it's got a lot of ingredients in like dehydrated garlic and dehydrated onion. The pepper has a little bit more spice and pepper to it. And then we actually used a whole host of different natural flavorings. For the natural version, there's an artificial flavor. Food technician magic made it all happen.
And those food technicians, do they work for you, or do you simply order in the product from somebody else?
Well, actually, we were extremely fortunate. One of my best friends from college, his father actually turned out to be the CEO of a very, very large dry goods and food development company in the U.S., and he was who helped us make, and they had, I think, 16 or 18 food scientists on hand who helped us work on bacon.
And it's just taken off like a rocket. I mean, did you expect that to happen? I mean, it sounds like it was a whole sort of a tongue-in-cheek kind of joke almost.
I definitely in the beginning told people it was a joke that went too far, but now because it's my full-time career, of course I knew it was going to be this big.
Justin, what were you doing before?
Dave and I both actually worked for a tech company in Seattle. It was a social kind of networking, social media company called Jobster.com.
Uh-huh. So now, I mean, I might say about this that it's kosher, vegetarian, non-perishable. It's zero calories, zero fat, zero carbohydrates, sugar-free, and low sodium.
That's right.
It's too good to be true.
And the amazing thing about it is it actually tastes good. Ann said before we do this interview, we better try some of this. And I said, but you already did. I just didn't tell you. I fire roasted some green tomatoes last evening on the grill to go with what we were having for dinner. And instead of sprinkling it with regular salt and some kind of barbecue powder and some fresh ground pepper, I just used the little sachets of bacon salt that came with the I think we picked those up at the Fancy Food Show in New York, which is where we met you. And I sprinkled it on. on, and Ann said, these tomatoes taste really good. And I never had the chance to tell her what the secret ingredient was, but that's exactly what it was. And I think you were telling us off the air that this is one of the ways that you tested the product to begin with?
It was. When we first got the, well, so you should know, when we first, we tried to make bacon salt ourselves without using food scientists' help. That was a total failure. It was terrible.
I wouldn't even imagine how you'd begin to do that.
We fried some bacon, took the bacon out of the pan, and then poured the drippings over some sea salt.
Oh, how disgusting.
It was terrible.
And that wouldn't be real kosher either, would it?
No, it was real gross and had a shelf life of about one half of a day. But when we first got the samples back, it was they got mailed to Dave's house. He called me. He said, come over right now. I get out to his house. He's like, I'm not going to tell you anything. You just try it. And he literally just had this big brown paper sack, and on the side of it was like a post-it note taped onto it that just said, bacon salt. And we ate it, and I freaked out. I was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And Dave, his wife, has been a total saint about this whole thing. He's got two little kids that are 2 and 3 at the time. We literally took every piece of food in the house out of the fridge, out of the cupboards, you know, everything, and just started cooking everything in the house and eating it on everything. And the first thing we ate it on was actually just a cherry tomato we cut in half, bacon salt on, and ate it down, and then tomato soup and steaks and chicken and fish and broccoli and beans and just everything.
Now, this has gotten to be a pretty big thing already, right?
Yeah, it's grown really, really fast. Our one-year anniversary of selling bacon salt was on July 16th, so it was just about 3 weeks ago. And in 1 year, we went from, you know, starting with a website and not knowing anything at all. I mean, we were based out of in a garage in Seattle on a website to now we're in over 5,000 stores. In all 50 states. It's been shipped to 47 countries. And
tell us about the MREs.
Oh, the Operation Bacon Salt?
Yes.
We do. We get it. We offer, as you mentioned, a vegetarian, kosher, shelf-stable, bacon-flavored seasoning salt. And we get a lot of requests from the Middle East, from troops from, from the U.S. and a lot from the U.K. and Canada and Australia that are stationed over there. And there's no access to pork. There's no bacon because in Muslim countries it is illegal. And so as more and more requested it, we finally decided to start a kind of a charitable initiative. Anybody can go to operationbaconsalt.com and check it out. baconsalt.com/operationbaconsalt. And we donate free bacon salt to troops. And it's gone really well, and people have really, really liked it.
Well, you know, I don't think that the whole world should taste like bacon, but somebody explain to me, why is everybody so totally nuts and enamored of bacon? I mean, I think I mentioned you when I saw you in New York that we had two entire books about bacon this year that we got review copies of.
And, you know, bacon's a cult. Bacon is America. That's what I like to tell people.
In the South, it's like a cult thing. That's for sure.
Yeah,
you can add bacon to anything and make it taste. Bacon or chocolate, and now people even combine bacon and chocolate.
Oh, is there bacon-flavored chocolate, probably?
There's a chocolate bar that actually has a strip of bacon on the inside of it. It was made, I think it was Chicago is where it came from.
Oh, it sounds like something Vogue chocolates would do.
That's who did it. It was Vogue chocolate.
Oh, okay.
It's amazing that you guessed.
I don't know.
Well,
that.
Listen, this is, shall we call this a Horatio Alger story? This is really quite remarkable. A crazy idea in a bar to come up with a product. It's taken off like a rocket. As a result, Justin and his partner David have abandoned their previous career in high technology and are dedicating themselves to propagating the world with bacon salt. I'm sure there's a website where you can go to find out where you can lay your hands on the product, Justin?
Baconsalt.com.
That's okay. A surprise. I wouldn't.
Yeah, I had another question.
Go ahead.
Like people who are recovering alcoholics think that it's cheating to have these non-alcoholic beverages that come in beer-shaped drinks. And what do Orthodox Jews think of this? Or what about rabbis? You have to have it certified by rabbi, don't you, to make it kosher?
That's right. And so I'll take those one at a time.
Okay.
So first, for the kosher foods, it's really been a phenomenal response. Typically, we get somebody at the end of the phone and it starts off with something like, you want me, you have what? And you want me to do what with it? You know? And then once we get past the humor of it, they look at it, they inspect it, and then they say, you know, that's a great idea, and it's really fun and funny. And we started out actually with a Square K Hecture, which is here in Seattle, which is a regional Hecture. And then we went to Scroll K, and now actually we've been able to get the product Cough K certified, which is on the very high end of kosher certification, which we're really happy about. And it's something that, you know, hopefully we hope to export to Israel. The appetite for bacon products is really very high. Everyone likes the flavor of bacon. It's delicious.
Yeah, you're absolutely amazing, young man, Justin. It's just not something that we really were prepared for. As we started to investigate bacon salt and talk with you, but we're so glad that we had the opportunity to meet. And on your menu, listeners around the world, get on this. This is really absolutely surprising and amazing.
And I think, Justin, you and your partner's enterprise should be rewarded by everybody ordering a bacon salt.
Well, we really do appreciate it. We ship anywhere in the world. As we've hit more and more countries, we're actually sitting here waiting to figure out what the 48th, 49th, and 50th country will be that we ended up shipping it to. It is available everywhere in the U.S., and it's gaining popularity in other countries. It is available in some parts of Canada and Mexico, Guam, Singapore. I think Jamaica and Barbados picked it up recently. And, you know, we're working on exporting it to Colombia right now. And
so put a little cocaine in there.
Come on now, Ann.
There's just no end. So you'll have to keep in touch with us and let us know when you come up with something new and exciting so that we can keep our listeners abreast of developments in bacon salt and related products, because I'm sure you're not going to stop here.
Oh, guys, we have the most fantastic product coming out in 2 months. You're going to love it. It's in the bacon space. It's bacon-related. I cannot tell you what it is right now, but I will absolutely send you some samples of it and the information as soon as it comes out. And your listeners, if they liked bacon salt, they're going to love this.
We can't wait to welcome you back on the program. In the meantime, Justin, keep up the good work, and thank you so much for joining On the Menu.
Thanks,
hey,
Justin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So there you have it, listeners. As Ann said earlier, you heard it here first. Don't be surprised what we might come up with next. But now it's time to say goodbye for another week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.